Welcome to Truth Nation, Chief Mark Garrett. It's hurricane season in Florida. Are you hanging in there?
Yeah, you know what? First time for over a year. This one's got me a little on edge. Not sure yet where it's going to end up, but it's coming our way. So next probably 24 hours, we'll know about where.
Okay, as long as we got 45 minutes, you can don your life jacket after that, right?
Bill, thanks for being so considerate. I love you too.
Right. Mark, we got a tremendous guest today. We're going to talk about two things. And I really, as soon as I saw these two documents, I thought of this guest. The things we're going to talk about are the whistleblower report that was issued by, what is it, Hawley? Hawley?
Josh Hawley.
Josh Hawley, regarding Secret Service actions around the first Trump assassination attempt. And the second thing is a summary we're going to talk about of a internal after action review that Secret Service did on their own people and you know, their own activities surrounding that shooting. Our guest today, third time on the show, a former New York City Police Department homicide investigator, former ATF special agent. As a special agent, he was at one time the deputy assistant director for the ATF, basically overseeing a large chunk of what this international law enforcement organization does every day. And also, I think, especially interesting for this conversation, Pete, you were the special agent in charge of the Miami ATF office.
Yeah, I was down there for Parkland Pulse,
yep.
The Fort Lauderdale airport shooting. So I've had the misfortune of having to respond to
that. And I feel like that's important just for the leadership lessons you learn when you're working on the operational side as you know, in essence, a chief. That's what you are as a special agent in charge, just like Chief Garrett here. And also the other reason, I think the real reason why people should be thrilled to hear what you have to say and interested to hear what you have to say is you're a best-selling author now. The name of the book is Deadly Path, How Operation Fast and Furious and Bad Lawyers Armed the Mexican Cartels. Folks, if you haven't picked up this book and read it, please do so. It's an expose of what can go wrong in government. And, you know, I'm proud, Pete, to say I know you. I've come to know you over the past 6 or 8 months as someone who demands accountability and who does and says what's right, regardless of personal consequence. So this is going to be a real interesting conversation to have with you. You testified before Congress. You were, I would say, one of the more influential or one of the more better known federal law enforcement whistleblowers. So I thank you for coming on today and talking to us about this this shooting attempt on President Trump.
Thanks, Bill. I'm honored to be here with you guys. And look, you read the book and you know that in the book, I talk about mistakes made by the organization, but I also talk about some of the mistakes I personally made. Mm-hmm. And what bothers me about what I'm seeing today with the two shooting incidents was just the lack of ownership, because leadership means ownership. And look, no one expects law enforcement to get it right every time. And I know we're going to talk about a lot more things in depth, but look, when you mess up, own it. Explain what you intended to do, how you got where you are, and how you're going to fix what happened. And that's one of the more disturbing things here is that, especially in the beginning under Director Cheadle, that was missing. I mean, glaringly. Yeah. So again, you know, we're going to talk about some mistakes were made. We perhaps talk about some ideas about how things could be made better. But as a law enforcement leader, you have a duty to own what went wrong. And that's the thing that I'm really upset about is just that the absence of that ownership and the finger pointing, you know?
Yeah. Hey guys, the first thing that I saw that jumped out at me. And now first we're going to talk about the whistleblower report, right? Mm-hmm. Which was released, I think, on September 16th, shortly after the second attempt on Trump's life. They put this whistleblower report out, and I'm sure, Pete, as you can attest, there's still calls coming in. There's still people out in the field reporting on what's happening. But one of the things that I noticed that was right up near the top of the list of issues is the Secret Service's Counter-Surveillance Division. They performed threat assessments of, they're supposed to perform threat assessments of the event site. They didn't perform a typical site evaluation here, and they weren't present on the day of the rally. Now, I have heard, Pete, and I'm sure you've talked to people who have been involved in the periphery or directly involved, whatever. I've talked to people that I know, and they've said that they've had events at this site before that Secret Service has run, let's say, security for. So they kind of defaulted to, we're going to do what we did last time type of mentality. And Man, that's troubling. And here's an example of that, right? So I have a job that I do for the state part-time. And one of my responsibilities, it's at sporting events. One of my responsibilities is ensuring the safety of the participants in the event. And there's doctors on staff, right? There's paramedics on staff. There's two ambulances standing by. There's venue security that's coordinated with. These venues don't change. It's the same venues. We're always at the same venues. So when we show up there, we don't say, hey, guys, you know, we just did this last week, last Sunday here. It's going to be the same thing. You guys know what to do. No, we go through each step. It's almost like a pilot checking off, looking at his checklist. And you do a walkthrough each and every time with everybody that's involved. And you know what? You'd be surprised how often you find out, okay, there's a gate that's closed on this parking lot now that wasn't closed before. What are we going to do about that? Or there's a door here that's closed now that's locked, and there's not even a door handle on it anymore. What happened? What I'm saying is there's things that were taken for granted, complacency here. They just assumed things would be done the same as they always were. And also, I feel like that doesn't take into consideration the threat. It's almost like we have a venue and the security program is based on the venue rather than on the protectee and the threat level to the protectee. Is there something to that, do you think, or is this just plain and simple complacency?
I think it's both, actually. Look, to your point, complacency kills. And in this instance, it almost killed the current nominee for the Republican Party and a former president. And it certainly killed a gentleman firefighter that was sitting in the crowd. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to go through the same thing. It's funny in ATF, like what we used to hate was when we would get operational plans. Maybe it was the third or fourth buy into a case, right? And you would see that it was cut and pasted from the previous plan rather than just going over the whole thing again. And again, to your point, things change. The other thing is, yeah, they'd worked this venue many times and maybe they had worked with these departments many times. But I mean, departments hire new people, people move on. So you may be dealing with folks, even though you've dealt with a certain police department 20, 30 times, nothing says that the people that are involved from that police department aren't new or don't, And so, I mean, there's a lot of things where they dropped the ball. There weren't meetings where they should have had meetings. You've seen this. And look, I'm not going to lie and say that I haven't seen it within my own former organization, ATF. Everyone who's participating in an operation is supposed to sit there for a briefing, correct? Now, if you are not there for that briefing, there were times we would send people home. Hey, you weren't at the briefing. Get out of here. I mean, it's provided we had the assets. If not, then we would have a second briefing to make sure everybody was caught up. And then after the operation, we would have a post-op briefing to talk about what went wrong. There were discussions amongst people where, well, we kind of, we asked for help and we passed information on to others. And we asked, so there were people who never spoke to people from the Secret Service that were there. And then the Secret Service also, and this has been discussed ad nauseum, they never bothered to check that some of the things that were critically important to cover were covered. So there were a lot of assumptions made and it almost cost, nation dodged a bullet. But
yeah.
Yeah,
we almost didn't.
Hey, Pete, to that point about, and we've talked about this before, actually the three of us and Bill and I on this show before, but the partnerships between agencies, and you touched on that with your statement, and something specific, there are a lot of specifics, but one of the things was, this wasn't even a case of the Secret Service being lackadaisical or not reaching out. You had local law enforcement offering up a number of times their drone assets, and the Secret Service affirmatively declined it from what this report says, from what I can gather.
Yes.
This to me it crosses the Rubicon here of overlooking stuff, of being lackadaisical, like you're talking about cutting and pasting from the last ops plans, to actually actively denying resources. And that's beyond my understanding. I'll tell you right now, the California Highway Patrol, whenever we could work with a partner agency, they could offer resources that we didn't have or didn't have available at the time, whatever it is. If it were appropriate, we say, absolutely, thank you so much, and let's coordinate. I don't understand how this happened this time.
Yeah, let me, Pete, jump in and say two things on this. First is, by the way, for people out there who are saying, hey, I'm not in federal law enforcement, like, what does this have to do with me? This exists. Complacency and let's just call it incompetence at some level, some is greater, sometimes greater than other times. It exists in every business. If you're listening or watching this, it exists where you work. Why did it show up in this case so glaringly? It's a zero fail mission, right? And Pete, I think you and I have talked about this, and if not, maybe it was Mark and I, that on the investigative side, what happens when resources are cut? We do less investigations. So does the public know? Does the public know necessarily that we're being less effective? Not really, because they don't know what the numbers mean. But when you're on a protection detail and there's cuts, you see it because it's a zero fail mission. And if you think this is not going on in your business, you're wrong. It is. You just need to look at maybe a different way to evaluate things.
Sure. Well, look, to touch on both your points, Mark, you were with CHP. I'm sure you dealt with a lot of different agencies because you covered the entire state. And sometimes you probably dealt in sweeps or you know, dignitary movements, all kinds of different cases. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'll say, and I'll go back to even my time with the NYPD, and I don't know if Secret Service has this institutional arrogance, right? We know FBI at times shows it, right? But I was with the NYPD where at times we would work a case that spanned into like a nearby town like Yonkers, New York or Mount Vernon. And when those departments would offer something up, there were times where the NYPD bosses would say no, almost out of like a sense of institutional arrogance, like, hey, we got this, you know. So right. I don't know if that might have factored into what happened, why they declined the drone. I think it's idiocy. If you can have an eye in the sky, whether it's yours or somebody else's, why wouldn't you? But the other thing that troubled me was the communication issues that came up. And I think we've all seen this, because what happens is, like, when I would run large scale takedowns in Miami, for example, you know, we'd have multiple agencies, Broward County Sheriff's Office, sometimes Miami-Dade, which are behemoths in their own right. And then some smaller entities, we would offer up radios at times. We'd have them, you know, sent in. We'd have a communication specialist on hand, make sure everything's keyed in. And there were times where other agencies wouldn't want to take the radios, because if they lost it, it's a $5,000 radio. I'll just use my own. And then there were times where, you know, other agencies that we would work with wouldn't offer up radios, and we didn't have. So, I mean, comms issue is something that's common. It happens a lot. I know there's a lot of finger pointing about why the entities didn't talk to each other. But when you're talking about protecting a president or a possible future president, you know, it's a little bit different than some street takedown that you're doing. You know, and you still want it to be amicable. You want to have those comms. But here, the fact that entities working that same event weren't able to talk to each other, it really shows it just a dramatic lack of really initiative to do things right. I mean, that's a big, big way of dropping the ball, to not be able to talk to people when you have, I mean, especially when somebody's on a roof, people are screaming stuff out about a guy on the roof. Some people say that there's a rifle involved, and it still took about an hour to get the, I mean, had they communicated that, they might not even let Trump take the stage. But I mean, some of the balls that were dropped here are astounding when you look at it, you know, in hindsight. And look, I get it. Hindsight's 20/20, but again, to your point, this is a zero fail mission. They have to get it right every time. The bad guys only got to get it right once.
Yeah. Right. And Pete, to go to your point about communication, I think what made it worse in this case was that some of the locals actually thought they were communicating with everyone. So when they did the after action, they came back and said, no, we were communicating these things. We thought everybody heard us. We thought everyone was on this frequency. So the only thing worse than not being able to communicate and knowing you can't communicate with everyone is putting out information and thinking everyone's on that same page as you. And the reality is they were not, and they didn't know what was going on.
Right. But I mean, even more reason, like we discussed before, in that pre-op briefing to get everybody together, to do your radio checks, to make sure things are working, rather than to be there when shit goes sideways and then you realize that things, or even worse in this instance, they thought they were being heard, which makes it even worse, because had they realized that they weren't being heard, they may have taken the plan B. So, I mean, this is even worse than it would have been, you know, in other situations. But I mean, that's why it's so important, the planning part. And look, I've been involved in, and I'm no expert in it, but I've been like the UNGA, the UN General Assembly, I've been involved in protective details. I know the planning that goes into it. It's painstaking. It's not glamorous work. I get it how it can get old. So that, because of that, I get it how things could fall apart. But, you know, there's no excuse for it. You know, again, going back to what we're saying, complacency kills. And we know that this isn't something that's probably very interesting to do all the time. It gets mundane. It gets routine. But that's why it's that much harder, but also more important to make sure that it actually gets done.
Yeah, and Mark, to your point about the drone, let me tell you what I heard about the excuse for that. And I think it goes to the accountability part that Pete's talking about, where there's it's still lacking, right? Mm-hmm. What I heard was, since Secrets, they thought better to have no drone than to have a borrow a drone, a local drone, and put it up there. This way, they said, if there's any drone up there, everyone knows it's a foe, right? It's not a friendly. But it turns out that the guy did fly a drone over there, right?
So exactly.
It's like, how does that work? Right. You know, you can't say that that's why you didn't use one if you were defeated. I'm sorry, Bill,
but to that point, it's exactly right. So the question would be, logically, well, have Secret Service, have you ever used a drone, or have you ever used an allied agency's drone previously? Mm-hmm. For POTUS, for VPOTUS? And if the answer is yes, that negates that explanation right there from their point of view. It's not consistent. We're talking about being consistent here. And like you said, Pete, you were involved in these planning meetings. I was involved. I ran the detail for Southern Division as an assistant chief for a couple of years. And before that, 20 years rank and file, driving the lead vehicle in front of the president, things like this. So I was immersed in this for 20 years. Like you said, the planning that goes into these visits, these movements, is not glamorous. It's very tedious. And the problem is, you can fall into a false sense of security if you're not careful. I think even the Secret Service, because it's, in other words, it's redundancy and you can get too familiar with it. And it's like a traffic stop on my part. There's no typical traffic stop. And if you treat them like that, bad things can happen. But on the other end of that spectrum, as far with the tediousness and the repetition, things like the complacency, I have seen the lengths to which Secret Service has gone to do a fantastic job at protection. And up to and including calling me directly, hey, Mark, hey, listen, President Obama is going to be XYZ Hotel and blah, blah, blah. He's going to speak in this room. And we're a little uncomfortable with the line of sight through these windows over here. We need some concrete K-rail to put behind those windows. Do you have any resources? So I got the phone and I called Caltrans. Hey, can you get me 12 of these K-rails? They brought them out in low boys and we surrounded this area the Secret Service is talking about. I say that because I know what the Secret Service is capable of when they do a proper assessment and they're taking their job seriously. And in my opinion, for the most part, they always have. But this is a case where there is none of that, in my opinion. And to me, it's mind-boggling.
Oh, yeah. And then you look at the roof excuse that they made. Well, the roof is too sloped. And anyway, when they would prove that, no, it's almost flat. I mean, it's not. It was too hot. Come on. I mean, all of their excuses fell on deaf ears. And that's why I mentioned earlier, like the lack of accountability, not just for the people who messed up, but for the people who were supposed to own it, the senior leaders, really was off-putting. It really was, deeply.
A big issue that I see with this, and Pete, I want to know if you experienced this, because for sure I did. And when this first came out several months ago, I remember bringing it up to Mark. I think it was Mark, you and I and Marcelo were talking about this. And I said, no, people, here's how this works. And this was, the Office of Protective Operations told the field office, don't request additional resources because it won't be approved. So that's kind of the out they have, right? So when they're asked, were any requests for additional resources denied? What's the answer? The answer is no. Mm-hmm. The answer is no. They can honestly say the answer is no, but they were told not to request them. And I've seen that in my agency where you're told, hey, don't request this. This isn't going to get approved. Or sometimes there would even be a request. And guess what? You just would never hear an answer, Pete. You would never hear an answer and it would just die on the vine. And you'd almost wonder, like, did it not get to the right person? And, that's kind of like the way the game is played to avoid accountability for making tough decisions. Did you see that at all in ATF or Mark and CHP?
I saw it in both NYPD and ATF, frankly. As a homicide detective, there were times I needed resources to work a case. Sometimes it could be something as simple as, hey, I need money to dump a phone, because it used to be that you had to pay $500 to the telephone company to get the incoming and outgoing calls. And then they had this thing, if you did it on the weekend, you got 3 days for the price of one. It was actually kind of comical when you think about it. But I had homicides that would have been closed where I was told, I find another way because they didn't want to kick up that money. And ATF, it happened to look, I call it bureaucratic doublespeak. You know what I mean? And the bureaucracy will always protect the bureaucracy. I mean, that's the problem. The bureaucracy's goal is to keep itself going and sometimes to grow. And, and they don't like anything that contradicts those two things.
Yeah. You know, for me, Bill, I got to say that the Highway Patrol and their massive, massive, you know, chain of command, like any other large agency and bureaucracy and things like that, and a lot of political ramifications depending on the request and relationship. But for the most part, we were able to, at the ground level, make those types of requests. And we really pride ourselves on having these good relationships with the local law enforcement, with our allied agencies out there. So for the most part, we didn't experience too much of that from my point of view. You talk to another chief or another captain or something like that in another part of the state, it might be worse. But we actually had a very good relationship in Los Angeles County, where I spent my 30 years, because we worked directly with LAPD, LA County Sheriff's Department, FBI, DEA, ATF, so much. And we were so entrenched, you know, in a good way with it. I think that our communication, our coordination and relationships are pretty stout.
Yeah. Guys, what about the premise? One of the other things I saw here was, and this is again in the whistleblower report, was that the agent who was in charge or had the specific responsibility for security of the rally site, including line of sight concerns, et cetera, was, quote, known to be incompetent, unquote. And that incompetence led to the placement of items like flags around the stage, impairing visibility, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that I think also, if I'm not mistaken, guys, that they said this agent failed a particular exam while in the training academy, right? Is this a broader discussion now where we're talking about standards and difficulty recruiting and just who we're getting in federal law enforcement or any law enforcement? Or is this more that in any big agency, any big company, public, private, doesn't matter, there's going to be people who are allowed to skate, and there's not going to be sometimes the individual accountability that there should be? I mean, Pete, I know I've seen it. I've seen supervisors come in my office and complain about people, and I'll pull up the last evaluation where they were rated as outstanding. And I see you smiling, so I know you know what I'm talking about. And say, how can you complain that this person's not doing anything when you rated, oh, boss, you know how it is, boss, you know.
Bill, I'll tell you this, man, and we have a mutual friend, I won't name him here, who when he would have an employee who was not thriving, he would want them whacked at the headquarters. And at the time, I was a deputy assistant director in headquarters, and I would always say, all right, well, what did you do to address the problem?
Right.
Well, you know, I had a conversation that I would always go into our HR system and look at that employee's evaluation. And without fail, it was the highest possible evaluation. So, I mean, look, this is a great question, and I'm glad you asked it, because there's so many layers to it. Mm. A lot of it is mismanagement. People don't want to have difficult conversations with employees because they're afraid they're going to get filed on. So they'll just give them the best possible evaluation because they don't want to hear the gripe about, hey, how come I'm not getting my bonus this year? And people just continue to be bad at their job, where the manager can refer them for training or put them on a PIP or do whatever. So that's one issue. The other issue is, because one of the roles I had towards the end of my career was I was the head of training and recruiting for ATF. Mm. So when you talk about some of the failures, why they've changed how they do training, look, truthfully, some of it comes from a lawsuit that actually the FBI was hit with, where they were canning a lot of female agents. And the belief was that the people doing the tactics training at the academy were former HRT types, you know, real gung-ho, and they were failing females at a higher rate than should have been. So they lost a lawsuit, and that caused a lot of other federal law enforcement agencies to pivot. So now, like, for example, at ATF, it used to be that you got a chance to qualify. If you failed to qualify with your pistol, you got one more chance. Mm-hmm. And if you failed that second qual, you're gone. Which is sad, you're terminated. That changed into you need to qualify by the time you graduate the academy, because they didn't want to get sued. And so, I mean, a lot of it comes out of precedent that comes from other agencies. But then the other thing is, and to your point, look, when we came on the job, we're old farts, right? The profession was viewed differently. Like, it was viewed as a noble profession. It was viewed as something you tried and strive to achieve to. For a lot of the people that are getting hired now, and I don't want to say all, because we hire some exceptional people in law enforcement. A lot of them come from the military. Some of them come right out of college. But for a lot of them, it's not a calling like it was for many people back in our day. It's a job. And that's why what you see now is you see people come into law enforcement, do a couple of years, and leave. When I was a rookie cop, man, I worked with plenty of guys that had 30, 35 years on a job. They stayed till they were carried out of the building. Mm-hmm. Now people, they don't do that anymore. And part of it I blame on politicians who have demonized the law enforcement profession. And it's no longer viewed as a place where the people who work there were revered and trusted anymore. So, you know, I think some of the political rhetoric has done a lot of damage to our profession, and it's lasting damage because, you know, again, the quality of people we're hiring, I don't want to paint with broad brush, but it's not what it was when I first came on with the agency. It's a different people look at the job itself differently, the profession differently. And I think as a result, we're getting a different caliber of people, some very good, but some who might not have made it back in the days where more people competed for these jobs.
Mark, anything to add on that?
Not much. I think, Pete, you did a fantastic job of covering that. I will say the one thing about the fact that Josh Hawley, you actually used those words that known to be incompetent. That's very, very impactful. It's very telling that a representative, a senator, would actually put that in writing. That means he's actually gotten deep in the weeds and he's heard this over and over and over from various people with whom he's had conversations. And there are a number of reasons, the documentation, their lack thereof, or improper bill. We both talked about it. But there's also another reason. Sometimes things are somewhat intangible. It's certainly, you can check the boxes and say, hey, they're incompetent, or you have this tendency or not. But sometimes people are just a pain in the ass. And supervisors don't want to deal with them. And so they figure out a way to move them from my chain of command to someone else's chain of command. Yep. It happens all the time. It happens all the time. They move the problem to somebody else. And then eventually something like this happens and then it gets documented. And then people ask, why? Well, because someone didn't take care of
business. If I can dovetail into what you said, that can swing both ways, actually, though. Because, yes, some people are substandard employees, right, who work for a good boss who, you know, are failing. I've also seen that dynamic work. And I'm not saying that's the case here, where you have a boss who maybe doesn't have that same experience level as the people he's supervising. And the agents or cops or detectives are hard chargers. Mm-hmm. And there's that conflict because the boss is a bit risk averse, mm-hmm. right? And the agent is a gung-ho agent and the boss doesn't want to deal with that risk of managing that gung-ho agent. So all of a sudden now that gung-ho agent becomes retroactively incompetent and is marginalized too. So that's a weird thing that I've seen happen both at ATF and in the NYPD. I've seen weak managers ostracize spectacular agents because the work that the agent did was above the comprehension level of the manager. And the manager, rather than learn it or trust his agent, would try to chicane that agent and send him somewhere else or shut him down, which causes a whole different host of problems, morale and, you know, whatnot.
Yep. And I do agree with what you said, Pete. The rhetoric from politicians, let's say going back 2020, 2021, it's almost become self-fulfilling rhetoric where people hear that. And why do you want to go into that career, right? Why do you want to choose that as your profession when that's what you're hearing about day in and day out?
The big one is institutionally racist.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, your policing is, in today's day and age, to be called a racist is a career killer. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. it's about the worst thing that you could be called, except for perhaps a rapist or a murderer. So what that turns into is, why would I want to enter a profession that's racist? And who that affects the most is people of color and Latinos. Look, I've seen it, and I'm sure you gentlemen have seen it, where you have a black officer and you have members of the community say, man, you're a turncoat or you're a traitor. When in fact, these people are trying to do something good for their community, for the profession, for their country. So, I mean, it's really destructive. So a lot of the problems we're talking about here are obviously organizational, but there are external factors, and some of these politicians have really done a lot more damage than I think they could ever possibly fathom with their rhetoric.
Yeah, and it does go to manpower too, right? Because I know, and in fact, one of the things I want to talk about is the investigative mission of Secret Service, and I know that both ATF and DEA, they have a regulatory mission and a kind of criminal investigative mission. When you can't staff, right? When Secret Service can't staff properly their protective obligations, one of the reasons why is because they can't recruit. So it's definitely related. You know, it's an organizational problem, but that lack of ability to recruit and hire qualified people makes it a miserable place to work because it's a zero fail mission. The mission has to be staffed. Again, it's not like the investigative mission where if the work doesn't get done, the public really doesn't know. This is different, that the staffing has to happen. So people are being forced to work overtime. They're bringing back retired people. And that just makes for a less than desirable work culture where people start to hate it. They're away all the time. They're on the road. The hours are crazy. And I don't know, what was it? They ranked it as the fourth worst place to work or something like that. Do you guys remember what that was?
Yeah, it was low. I can't remember the number, Bill, but it was surprisingly low.
And what I'm saying is they want to make that about the culture, but that what I'm saying is that comes from the rhetoric. That comes from the inability to recruit, hire, and staff that's, you know, has political origins.
Yeah. Well, I'll go one step further. I'll have a question for you as well. Mm-hmm. Look, their protective mission is a boring mission. I mean, yep. To the public thinks it's glamorous. You're protecting the president. You got the cool sunglasses and the earpiece, right? But the reality is it's monotonous work. And I have deep, deep respect for the agents out there doing that job because it's not an easy job. With the investigative aspect, I had a desk at Southern District for 10 years in Southern mm-hmm. District, New York. So I got to know a lot of the agencies, and some of them did not like working investigative cases with Secret Service because you're working a case, you're about to really hit a stride, and then boom, your guy's pulled away for protective. So, I mean, there was this, it was a difficult cadence for them to work cases. But I mean, having them only do protective would probably bore them to death. And then the other thing I'll say is it's not just recruiting. I hired plenty. We used to get former Secret Service, former marshals, and former air marshals applying to us in mass. Because mm-hmm. they were bored with the mission. The air marshals were tired of farting into plane cushions. The U.S. Marshal guys who weren't on task forces didn't like standing in the back of a courtroom all day. Mm-hmm. And the Secret Service guys were tired of guarding a limo or guarding the hotel room door. So they would look to come to us. And I'm sure DEA had the same thing. You probably had a ton of former Secret Service agents applying yep. to DEA. So the question then becomes, to retain the best and brightest, how do you make that organization more appealing to keep people there? And that is a big challenge. Again, you're trying to talk about solutions because it's easy to criticize them for what's gone wrong.
Yes.
But I mean, how do you find the path forward? Because again, I know plenty of Secret Service agents, to include folks from the uniform division, they used to blow our phones up looking for a way out of the service, not because they hated the service itself, but the mission just wore them down. And the travel also being a big part of it, because a lot of them had families and they're on the road, especially during a campaign season, almost nonstop, which is challenging. So, I mean, how do you make it worth their while? Because we want to have the best and brightest there. So how do we get that done is the big question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And so that goes into this. And I'm interested to get your guys' opinion on this. And I got into it with the former Secret Service. I don't know. He was assistant director or something a little bit, because they're short on staff. They have to staff the protective mission. So what's happening at Secret Service, and it's in this whistleblower report, is they have Secret Service agents who are specifically trained in protection, and they're working an investigative mission at Secret Service. They're not doing protective work. So to backfill, Secret Service then goes to their parent umbrella organization, Department of Homeland Security, and says, we need people to help staff events. And that's not glamorous work, Pete. Like you said, the example I heard from a buddy I have who does that work is I'm looking at a stairwell. I'm standing looking at a stairwell for the whole day. But that person is being taken away from investigative work, child exploitation, drug cases, et cetera. And they have they either have no training on protection, or they called it in this report a webinar. The reality is it's a PowerPoint deck.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's a, you know, 100 or 300 slide PowerPoint deck. Is that what we should be doing? Does that make sense to take a trained Secret Service agent who knows protection, have them work an investigative mission, and then go grab someone that's doing an investigative mission at another agency who has no protective training and putting them on a protection detail?
No. And I'll tell you, this has been going on for decades, because don't forget, before the Homeland Security Act, Secret Service, Customs, and ATF yep. were under Treasury. So us, being ATF, and Customs were frequently tapped to help Secret Service because we fell under the same department. So this is something that's been going on for a long time. But yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, if they're that deficient in personnel to handle their protective mission, maybe they should not be working these internet cases or child cases when they have other entities that can do it. I know the marshals work some child porn cases. FBI does, DHS does. And then, you know, I mean, what do you do with the counterfeit mission? Is counterfeiting right. even really a big thing right now? Is it so important that we need to focus on that to be not capable of protecting the president or foreign heads of countries that visit? Because the Secret Service also does that as well, let's not forget. You know, so, I mean, yeah, it's a complicated question.
It's a complicated question. And Pete, you hit right on what I was going to say, which is great. I'm glad I'm thinking like you. I have to ask myself, is a counterfeit mission, in other words, under these circumstances, when you have a former president who has had two attempts on his life in basically the last 2 months, does the counterfeit mission, and God forbid these happens to any child, but does a child exploitation mission, do these supersede the importance of protecting these heads of state, former heads of state, for presidents, vice presidents, things like that? And does it mean that these cases are going to fall through the crack if they are turned over to other agencies? Look, California Highway Patrol has numerous officers on child exploitation, child pornography task forces, FBI, LA County Sheriff. I'm talking again, LA County, where I worked, but you name it. So there are countless agencies that not only do these types of investigations, but are very, very good at it, that work along with the Secret Service. The counterfeit mission is exactly what I was going to talk about. Is it necessary for them to retain that role? Now, we'll say this, for every agency, and all of us have been a part of it, every agency is always looking for additional work, additional justification for their existence.
Bureaucracy growing.
You said it earlier. The bureaucracy is always protecting itself. I understand that. But at some point, I think, and with this investigation, the whistleblower report coming out, reports plural coming out, I think, at some point, the dam has to break and people have to say, listen, what is the most essential mission? What's the core mission of a particular agency? We have to shore that up first, and then we can go back later on. We get this all figured out, get this running like a well-oiled machine, then we can go back with some, you know, quote unquote ancillary duties. Was exactly what I wanted to talk about. And I think now that it's time that we seriously look at giving some of those things up. The other thing I want to say on this is a little different, I think, with the Trump assassination attempts, because all of us, by the way, all of us have people inside with great intel. All of us mm-hmm. know people who know more than we will talk about here on the air. And one of those people I know very, very well, so Mark, I've been around a long time. You know what I do, what I did, things like this. I have never seen anything close to the number of threats on Donald J. Trump that I've seen with any other president or former president. Doesn't come close. The next one was President Obama, he said. The next one was President Obama. Trump makes that pale in comparison. My point is this, is that the Secret Service certainly must have had plenty of information to make him more of a focus than they have to this point.
Well, if I can say two things, actually. First off, right after Fast and Furious happened, right, we got a new director. He was appointed by Obama, actually. His name was Beto Jones, former Marine JAG officer, former U.S. attorney for the District of Minnesota. And he came in, right, because you're talking about prioritization. ATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the E is silent, go figure. ATF got away from its alcohol mission because it was no longer important. But is it still happening? Yes. But they decided, hey, we needed to focus on the other things. During that period, prior to 9/11, terrorism was being partially funded with tobacco diversion schemes, right? And organized crime was used tobacco diversion schemes to generate money to do what it needed to do. He then came in and said, all right, well, I get it. Tobacco cases, which were not a huge portion of ATF's work, were a big portion. Because they generated a lot of seizures, a lot of money, a lot of revenue. That's how the Fish and Wildlife Service Academy in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which is a beautiful facility, by the way, was built, was with that money. So he said, nope, we're not doing that anymore either. Unless there's a violent crime nexus to us, we're going to focus on guns and explosives and arson, which goes bang, boom, and burn was his exact words. So here were the first two initials of the name. They were willing to walk away from those things to focus on what was important. So to your point, could Secret Service walk away from some of their responsibilities or shelve them for now to focus on what's important? Absolutely. But I think the difference too with respect to former President Trump is, look, you have elected officials referring to him as a threat to democracy. You have elected officials saying that basically he's going to come in and be a dictator, that he's Hitler. Unlike Obama, and look, I know there was some inappropriate rhetoric mentioned about him. Some of it was racial. Some of it was because his middle name was Hussein, whatever. Whether you like him or not, was it appropriate? No. But the rhetoric now is so much more vile and vitriolic than it was before, where, look, I actually think that some of our elected officials are fueling, and I'm not saying intentionally, I think stupidly they are, but not perhaps intentionally, or who knows, this hatred that's driving people to try to kill the former president, because they, in the mind of somebody who's perhaps a little bit demented, they think they're saving the country. So they think they're acting nobly when obviously murdering someone is not. And then I know we briefly spoke earlier before we went on about a letter that was found in possession of the second shooter, where he was offering up a reward for killing President Trump. So, I mean, there's a lot going on. And I think a lot of the blame falls very, very squarely on people who hold elected office in this country. I hate to say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one more thing on the threats and the specific threats. Because one thing we heard at the beginning of this is, hey, and we all know this to be the case, there is one level of protection for a sitting president. There's a level of protection for a vice president. There's a level of protection for a former president, and yet another level of protection for a candidate, right? But it's almost like there's no consideration given to the specific threats. And I don't know, am I the only one that sees that? And does there need to be a shift in focus where it's no longer like boilerplate? It's not like, well, if you fit in this category, you get this. I'd like to see it like, you know, maybe here's some broad guidelines, but we have to do something that's threat-based. Why isn't it 100% threat-based? You know, I could name a couple, former presidents, and you guys might say, oh, is he still alive? You know what I mean? But, you know, you're not saying that about Trump. So does there need to be a rework of how the Secret Service is assessing threats and allocating resources?
Well Pete, I'm going to give you the last word on this topic, just so you don't think I'm copying what you're saying, because you're always making such great points. But, Bill, I couldn't agree more. In other words, the term threat assessment, that's what it's there for. That's what a threat assessment is. It's to determine the level of threat, not because of a particular venue, not because of a particular date, but all the elements or a particular protectee. It's because of all of the elements you have to assess. Have to assess. And I agree 100% that it doesn't appear that this was part of the process when it came to former President Trump or comes to former Trump. But, you know, in other words, we do this, and I forget what the acronym stands for, but basically the SEER level for a particular venue. And, you know, in other words, is it a one, is it a two, a three, a four, or five? And it's not just the venue generally. I mean, it is, but you have to make an assessment of totality of circumstances. And my God, like I said earlier, when the information's out there that we know the number of real threats, by the way, at home and internationally against Trump, you would think that someone in the business, the U.S. Secret Service, or the Attorney General, the Secretary of DHS, somebody would say, this has to be dealt with. This has to be dealt with specifically and uniquely because this is a different situation. We can't put them into a category of A, B, C, D. They're president, vice president, former president, blah, 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 cabinet member. You have to look at the threat. I wanted to get that out there because this was itching at me. I'm glad I got a chance to scratch it. But Pete, take it over and fill in all the blanks I gave you.
Oh, I got nothing else to say other than there is a new category, though. That's a protective level for a former Secret Service director. Because now Kim Cheadle has a detail assigned to her that was assigned by the current president. So, I mean, they don't have the resources, but they can protect a woman who did an abysmal job testifying in front of Congress and who did an abysmal job running the organization. And look, one thing I'll touch on too, because we're bringing her up, is, you know, there was this big push, and I don't agree with some of the things that were said about diversity hiring and females. Mm-hmm. Look, because they were beating her up because of this she wanted to increase the Secret Service to 30% females by 2030. Mm-hmm. That's not a Secret Service initiative. That's something that came from outside and many, many, many agencies and many organizations, to include IACP and PERF, bought into it. So to put that on her shoulders, I think is an injustice. But she was not an effective leader. And her, again, when we talked before about leadership means ownership, yeah, her failure to own what happened with that first shooting was perhaps the biggest failure I've seen in quite some time, maybe since Fast and Furious, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, she has her own detail now. So, I mean, they're so strapped for resources, but they can protect her.
And, you know, and she's a law, she was a law enforcement officer.
Correct.
Yeah. A couple more things I want to touch on. This one I found interesting. The Secret Service, and I'm going to really, Mark, see, you know, I know you've been very involved in protective stuff and, you know, looking at venues, et cetera. The Secret Service says this site was chosen by the campaign staff and the site was a challenge. I really wish Marcelo was here to talk about this, because I remember when you and I spoke with him, he didn't make it sound like this site was all that complicated. I personally don't really see this site as a challenge if they had just done some very basic things. Am I off base on that, or is this site, do you think, really a challenge, or is this more excuse making?
Are you asking me, Bill?
Either of you guys.
Pete, go ahead and take it from your point of view.
Well, I'm not as knowledgeable of protective work as you, but I'll say from my perspective, from doing tactical operations in remote areas of the country, it seemed manageable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, Mark, you have a lot more experience in this than I do, so I'll defer to you because I could be completely wrong. But it seems, I mean, an open area, you know, if you have a big enough perimeter and you have the rooftops covered, including the one that's not quite as sloped as they said it was, you should be fine. But take it away, Mark.
Well, you know, and to be totally transparent, the vast majority of my experience is the movement, the transportation mm-hmm. component of the protected detail. And that's why the Secret Service came to CHP, because we're the experts in moving people from one place to another. And we did it very, very well. My experience and knowledge from venue assessment, because I never actually had any formal training. Highway Patrol does a great job of that as well. Very, very good. Because we protect a lot of state property, obviously within the state of California. But most of my experience from site assessment and threat assessment with venues comes through osmosis, from, you know, 20 plus years of being around with the Secret Service and listening to them explain. And by the way, all the briefings, I mean, the 100 briefings that I sat in over the years with this particular site, this venue, and just telling us what they're working on. So having said all that, yes, this venue, compared to what I dealt with in Los Angeles, from my informal training, looked like child's play, comparatively mm-hmm. speaking. You have these just nothing but line of sight every place. Now, line of sight, it sounds dangerous, and it can be, but that goes both ways. Mm-hmm. There's really nothing obstructing the Secret Service counter snipers to see wherever they have. They can set their perimeter as large as they want to in that situation. And that's the beauty of having open spaces like that. Unlike if you're in downtown Los Angeles, I mean, my God, you're confined across the street. That's it. That's what you have. So I don't see why this is a challenge. Again, from my informal point of view, it seems like this would have been as doable as any venue that I dealt with. I'll put it that way.
That's what I thought. Go ahead, Pete. Go ahead.
Since I'm a guest, I know I'm going to break the rules. I want to ask a question of you gentlemen.
Yeah.
Where the hell is Alejandro Mayorkas?
Well, yeah. I mentioned him a minute ago.
That's why I'm asking. Like,
yeah. It completely, as we see in the CHP, UTL, unable to locate. Unable to locate. You would, my God, you would think, you would, by the way, it's not just him. It's also the AG. They're both of them. Both of them are incognito. Both of them have disappeared. This is something that, this is to your point earlier about the culture we're dealing with, Pete. If this had been, again, God forbid, we don't want harm or any possible harm to come to anybody. And for the purpose of this conversation, to any of these protectees, the vice president, the president, former presidents, candidates. But if this had involved Kamala Harris, do you think we'd be hearing from Mayorkas on a nonstop basis? And not only would we be hearing from him, not only would we be hearing from Joe Biden, as best he could cobble two or three words together at a time, it would all be race and gender centric. every single address that we would hear about the attempted assassination, the assault, whatever it is, would all be based on race and gender if it were Kamala Harris. So this is why we're not hearing from Mayorkas, is because this is a political opponent. We know they hate Trump. We know from this White House, from the campaign, we hear all the things you're talking about, Pete, about being Hitler, about being threatened every single day from everybody in that campaign, in that administration. So there's no way they can come out now and pretend that they're not responsible for some of these crazies taking up what they're saying and say, oh my God, if this person is Hitler, I better stop them. They are the ones that are promoting this. And here I've got my high horse. I try to keep myself a little bit under control. But
it's hard not to.
This is what we're dealing with.
Not just with this abysmal failure and his lack of ownership and lack of you know, stepping in and getting rid of somebody. With the border. I mean, I don't know that I've ever seen someone in a position that he's in be as bad at their job and maintain their job in my entire life. If he worked for my friend in Los Angeles, I would have been asked to bring him into headquarters.
Right. Yeah. Hey, the final thing I got, guys, is, you know, when the Secret Service did their after action, they specifically said resources did not figure into this failure. And I'm not sure how they can say that when they're bringing in a bunch of HSI, Homeland Security Investigation Special Agents, who really didn't have the training. And by the way, you know, I had heard that Congress had requested the names of everybody that was there, and DHS would not release the names because there was some fear that a good portion of them hadn't even done that PowerPoint training that we talked about, like that online training. So is this just a cop-out so that people are not looking at where the money is spent, or what is this? I mean, just because, and by the way, just because you have money doesn't mean you can hire.
Correct. Yeah, well, you know, I have a strong opinion on this, Bill. Some folks might not agree with it. It wasn't something that I think was agreed by people at my former level within government. Like, I believe that Congress has a legitimate right to oversight. They write the check. They have a legitimate right to oversight. I think organizations need to be forthcoming when there's an inquiry. Own your mistake. Explain how you're going to fix it. Let's not forget, in Operation Fast and Furious, which happened in 2011, the hearings occurred. Mm-hmm. They didn't get some of the documents they requested till roughly 2019. Yeah. That is not how government should work. The taxpayers themselves should be up in arms about this, because it's their money that's paying for this. We should care that our money is being spent wisely. But this is just how the government works. They treat Congress like as if, hey, you don't have any to know, kind of screw off. And that's a problem that needs to get fixed, because that's why we have so much waste, fraud, and abuse in our country. That's why bureaucracies grow out of control. You know, I mean, God forbid, I'll tell you a quick story. I know we're not, you know, long on time. We created this training program at ATF that was designed to go out there and teach different things in the field division as a result of some of the lessons learned for Fast and Furious. And part of the presentation was that once this team was put together and this training occurred, the team's goal was to pass that knowledge onto the field and to go away. When I mentioned that last part, go away, you would think that I, like, you know, did something illegal or offended somebody's mother, because the thought of having something where you go out there and do something, and then the goal of that group is to disappear, went against what they believe in. Because in their mind, once you have a team, you need to do what you're doing, and then you need to add to your responsibility and take more and grow. And then you'll need a 15. And who knows, we can maybe get an SES in there. And that's part of the problem, is that the government tries too hard in many instances to be all things to all people, to grow and grow and grow, when there's oftentimes, hey, we did our job, and now it's time to fold up our tents and go away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you said it all there for me, Pete. I couldn't agree more. Congress has legitimate oversight. You know, whether it's FOIA, whether it's, you know, Public Records Act requests, things like this, the government, whether it's federal, state, or local, man, they have magical ways to drag on their feet and just ignoring lawsuits and court orders. And we've seen it to the nth degree here in this particular case.
That's all I got, guys. Mark, thanks for your input on this one. Pete Fraselli, our special guest, author of Deadly Path, How Operation Fast and Furious and Bad Lawyers Armed the Mexican Cartels, an expose on government, and also really a little beyond that, I think an expose on why one of the causes to the crime problem today. It used to be back in the day, Pete, and I know you remember this from being around New York City, when crime went up, there was this cry, get more cops on the street. And that today is not the problem. Today, I put the problem in the hands of prosecutors. There's fewer and fewer prosecutorial offices willing to file charges on people, fewer and fewer prosecutors willing to file charges on people. And that was a huge part of Fast and Furious. And I didn't know that until I read the book. People get the book. It's a great read. Pete, thank you for being with us today, and we'll see you all soon.
Honored to be here, guys. Take care.